You're listening to WWBC, Cocoa, Merritt Island, Melbourne, Titusville, and the Beaches, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI, Cocoa, Vieira, 94.7 FM, and W264AS, Melbourne, and Palm Bay, 100.7 FM.
Hello, space and treasure coast. This is Sita Biggie on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here on AM 1510. AM 1510, that is. We're also on three FM stations, FM 94.7, FM 99.9, and FM 100.7. We're also heard all over the world on the web, and we have an action-packed show today. Yeah. Ellen Little is here, and my friend Laura Klopp is here. Yeah. I said it correctly. Like a horse clippity clop.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's easy to remember. And so we're going to have a really fantastic show today. I invited Laura to join us today because a lot of my friends have been asking to share this experience on the radio. And why not? This is what life is all about. If you can find satisfaction in something and somebody else wants to share in it, why not? Let's just all have... It's great. It's just great for the community. It's great for me. It's great for Ellen. Because other people would be interested in booking shows as well and coming on and sharing whatever they want to talk about, a book, a nonprofit, maybe someone is trying to open a business, somebody is running for office, whatever it is. Viewpoint with Sita and Friends is fun, unscripted, very educational, and we give out very valuable information to whoever's listening. Ellen, I'm not sure if you saw what happened last night in California. I think it's Gilroy, California.
This morning, and they've identified the gunman. And, you know, once again, it goes back to what we talked about before.
Yes.
That it's sad that things get so, like, we get used to seeing that on TV now. We're kind of...
It's too normal.
Way too normal.
Right. And I don't know, Laura, if you saw that, but usually when someone gets shot and there's a massacre such as what happened, I mean, it's a festival. People went out to have fun, and I think it was a garlic festival.
Yeah.
It was a food
and
festival.
Food, right? And imagine the eyewitnesses were saying they were running, they were screaming, and everybody was saying, run, cover, take cover, right? And usually you will write something like my thoughts and prayers. I stop writing thoughts and prayers because you know what? It goes on in the news for a while and then it dies down and happens again.
That's what's going to happen. Everyone will talk about it for a day or 2 days and then there will be some other big news story, and nothing will get done to make substantial change.
I mean, we all ask for common sense approaches to gun violence, and we all ask for, people to pay attention, all the politicians, to what the moms are saying, Moms Demand Action, and they're asking for common sense changes. Nobody's asking to take away the Second Amendment, but they're saying to be responsible, right?
We need to have, this is another area where we just need compromise, where we need, some people have to say, all right, some people, you know, there will still be guns. We can't take away all guns. And some people, I think, need to say, all right, but which guns are really necessary for me to live my life and protect myself and use the guns for responsible purposes.
And there are so many gun laws that are on the books that we are not even complied with.
Yeah.
So, and I think you and I, Sita, had talked about this one time before. I think that if you're getting a gun, that the HIPAA law should change, that I want to know if you've been on psychotropic drugs before, you know, on some kind of antidepressant or something like that. That's the only thing I'm asking for. I'm not asking for get into people's privacy or Big Brother watching and all of those different things that people are saying, but I think that's just one thing that needs to be included with the laws that we already have on the books, like I said. And if we could just follow those laws, we'd probably be in much better shape, but unfortunately we've got too many loopholes.
Well, and you know what it is too? I think too many people, once elected, it's all about re-election. Yeah. And they're afraid to say things or do things that would interfere with the base. It's not about the base. It's about all of us in this together. When a six-year-old child dies in Gilroy, California, and the parents have to bury this child or cremate or whatever it is, all of us should be concerned, because who's next?
Well, and it's not just the base, it's the money. If you're running for re-election, you need money, and the NRA gives politicians a lot of money.
They do. Well, so for listeners who are tuning in to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, Ellen and I have a friend in studio with us today. Laura Klopp is here, and we are very excited. We're going to have two call-in guests today. The first one is Rick Singh, and he is the first state-certified appraiser ever elected to the Orange County Property Appraiser. Almost 20 years ago, he became a land appraiser, and his experience is proving that what he's doing in Orlando, Florida is, I mean, Ellen, I tell you, I read all his accomplishments and I'm amazed.
Yes.
He's saving the city a lot of money. The property values are up, and he's fair.
I was $51 million?
Yes.
Was that the right amount of money? I mean, that just seemed enormous. But do you remember he was on the show, it was in 2016, I believe it was, maybe right after he had first gotten elected, and he was talking about all the things that he was going to do, and he actually followed through and came through with everything that he said that he was going to do, including the electric cars, which I thought was a fantastic idea.
Right, and the thing is,
what a great example.
You know, a lot of people run for office and they say they're going to do something only because they want to be, they want to be elected, right? Mm-hmm. But he has a few things that I read off this morning on his website, and of course, I've been following him on Facebook as well. And some of his accomplishments, I see Laura is reading it. She'll read off some of his accomplishments as property appraiser. And a lot of people didn't even know that was an elected position, but it is.
That's right.
Yeah. So the Orange County Property Appraisal Office was recognized in 2018 by the International Association of Assessing Officers with its prestigious Certificate of Excellence in Assessment. And less than 1% of assessment authorities around the world have ever received that. And in 2018, Rick Singh himself was honored with the Ian McClung International Award for his efforts in the development of valuation professionals around the world and for the advancement of the assessment community in a global environment. And the Orange County Property Appraisals Office was honored by the Center for Digital Government with the 2018 Digital Government Experience Award, citing its effective online strategies for meeting constituent needs. And in 2019, received a Gold Stevie Award from the American Business Awards as the Customer Service Team of the Year. So he's been working on not only improvement of training of assessors, he's been working on working with creating better digital experience and on creating customer service for all the people in the county. I mean, on
it's
multi
amazing,
levels,
isn't it?
Like
yeah.
Level after level, he's improving the role of the property.
Right. And, you know, and here's the thing, you know, everybody, you know, you grow up, right? Everybody, you're like a toddler, then you go to elementary school, you go to middle school, you go to high school, you get married, and what you want the American dream, which is a home.
Right.
And what happens when you have a home? You turn it to your parents, because everything has to be clean and neat, and you don't want kids to bring people home without your knowledge. The home becomes your base; it's your foundation
but it's
for everything. Right?
Owning a home,
isn't
too?
It?
It's terrifying. Whoever, like the day you're going to sign those papers, you're like, I'm so happy and I want to run, and it's, you know, it's scary, and it's nice to know that the, like, I was reading some of his other accomplishments on another page, and I know that he makes it easier, for instance, for people to get their homestead, and he sets up basically temporary locations so that people can come in and apply. Things you wouldn't even necessarily think about if it's been a long time since you've done it, but it wasn't that long ago that we bought here, and it's a tricky process.
Well, and you have to understand what the property appraiser does as well, which a lot of people will write that check at the end of the year for taxes, but they don't understand the tax roll. And it's so important that we as taxpaying citizens understand who our elected officials are and what they're doing for us. Like, you know, we have the supervisor of elections, we have the school board, we have the property appraiser, we have the state representative. People don't really know what they do.
Yeah.
And some of the questions I got for Rick, and we'll talk to him in a second, were really interesting because a friend of mine said, well, make sure he talks about the homestead, right? So I think Rick's on the phone, Mr. Property Appraiser. Thank you for calling in on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. Ellen is here and Laura Klopp is here as well. And we are delighted that you're taking time out of your busy schedule to call us.
Thank you so much, Sita and crew. Thank you so much for having me on this wonderful program. I've been looking forward to it and happy to be here.
Yeah, well, you know, we were all talking about your accomplishments. And, of course, Ellen blinked twice. She said he saved Orange County, Florida at $51 million. We're just...
Actually, we put back $1 billion on the tax roll from homestead exemption, fraud, agricultural compliance, ensuring that those folks that say they are using their land for agriculture is doing that in a bona fide nature, and also auditing businesses to ensure that they're adhering to the state statute. So yeah, we've been able to put back $1 billion on the tax roll since taking office in 2013.
Well, thank you.
Congratulations.
You know, before we go further, we just want to say, you know, I remember when you were running for office, and I am so proud of you, as well as so many other people.
You.
You've done a fantastic job. You've represented the Asian American community extremely well. And of course, you have assimilated more than most people. So I just want to say, when people talk about how, you know, when we come to America and how we assimilate and give back, you are the person that I think about sometimes and how well you're doing. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in politics to a point where you ran for office?
Yeah, so let me touch on that real quick. You know, as an immigrant coming to America, and I came to this country when I was 10 years old, and immigrants' accomplishments here, as immigrants, we ought to be thankful to the people that have paved the way. And by that, I mean, people, immigrants that's coming to this country haven't had dogs chasing them to control them, haven't had water spouted on them, have not been, neglected to sit at the right counter. So what I'm talking about are really the champions of the civil rights movement that have enabled us to get these freedoms. These freedoms that we ensure today as immigrants were not given so easily. So people had to struggle for them. People had to die for them. And it's very, very important as immigrants that we keep that in the back of our mind. Many immigrants I see come today come with a ready-made situation and accomplish tremendously and forget where they've come from. So I wanted to put that on the table. My story is a very simple immigrant story. It's coming to America when I was 10 years old. My father had died in Georgetown, Guyana. I tell the story of coming from a very impoverished city, living in a very impoverished environment. No running water, no electricity, dirt floor. The quintessential third world country. And here I was, a 10-year-old child, coming to flying on an aircraft for the first time and landing at John F. Kennedy Airport, mesmerized by the lights and the kaleidoscope of sounds and everything that you can imagine. It had to deal with the frigidness of landing in the winter. So these are things that we all take for granted, but coming from a third world country to America is a very, very frightening thing, mesmerizing thing for a 10-year-old. And again, I grew up in the Bronx, New York. My mother worked 3 jobs as a maid to make ends meet. And she did a tremendous job in keeping us very well grounded, having us, get involved in community activities, going to temples, going to community events, volunteering, doing whatever we could to give back in our humble capacity. From there, I joined the military. I was a soldier at different parts of the country. Fort Eustis, Virginia, Fort Lindenwood, Missouri, Fort Polk, Louisiana, and relocated to Orlando in 1986, worked at the property appraiser's office after leaving a business in a very entry-level position. It's one of these entry-level positions that you worked. I went to night school, went to evening school, got state certified as an appraiser, went in the private sector, built an appraisal company, and decided to give back and run for office after President Obama got elected. That really inspired me to give back. You know, that rousing speech he gave has been impressioned in my mind, and I think all of us remember that speech. So that was my that's essentially the igniter for me for public service. I had never been politically active, but it inspired me to give back, and that's essentially what caused me to run for the office of property appraiser.
Right. Well, I think he inspired so many people because we felt as though we were included. And I think it's very important in today's climate for people from all walks of life to feel included in the United States of America. Because like you, you know, all of us who come here, we enter the United States with such hopes and dreams. And you're right. So many came before us to give us this opportunity. But I think we're living in a time of such division, and politics is so destructive right now. We have to strive back for so that we can have civility and respect again. And I think it comes from people like you and myself and so many of us. We have to come forward because, as you know, there's so many immigrants from the Caribbean and Latin America that don't get involved in politics. or they just don't vote. You know, they don't stay engaged, and I wonder why, because you and I, well, look at us, we're so passionate about it.
Well, and I have to say,
yes,
too,
absolutely.
As someone who's not an immigrant, who's been in the country and my ancestors, I want to express my appreciation to everyone who goes through the difficult process of coming to a new country, embraces that country, and then gives your personal knowledge and experience and intelligence and works to make all of our country, which is now your country, as well better. And I think more people need to be saying that. I mean, immigrants to our country provide so much beyond, you know, being members of the workforce, because it's what helps our entire community grow and understand new cultures and become just a bigger, more amazing conglomeration of people than it could be if we closed ourselves off. So thank you for coming and for doing such wonderful things.
Let me just qualify your statement. You're not a recent immigrant. You're a forefathers. I make that statement in a sense of profoundness, because all of us are immigrants.
Right.
That is
so
true.
So let's qualify that. One of the most joyous thing I've done as an elected official, one of the most rewarding thing I do as an elected official, is speak to newly minted citizens at the federal courthouse. These are folks that are getting ready to raise their hands and become citizens. And if any American want to count their currency as a citizen of this nation, they ought to go and sit and experience that, and experience folks becoming citizens of this country. It's an overwhelming experience. People from all nationalities speaking different languages, speaking a different degree of education. You know, it's just a melting pot, and it's phenomenal to watch that and watch the enthusiasm and pride and it's really the core, if you will, that they share to become new Americans. It's a wonderful experience.
You remind me of Judge Majee. That's what he did here in Brevard. But so before we go on to talking about what you do in the appraiser's office, why do you think so many people who immigrate and come here for a better life, like they say, why don't they get more engaged in our communities? Because I have had so many people that says, oh, why are you wasting your time? I don't have the time. And I'm like, it only takes 1 hour a month to volunteer for something. There's so much stuff going on, because to me, if you don't vote, you don't really have the right to complain, because that means you're accepting what the majority did.
I wish every immigrant,
you raise a very, very good point, Sita. In that, you know, so I think what happens to immigrants that come to this country, it's like a starving man, and I'm going to use this analogy. It's like a starving man walking through the ocean and see a fountain of water. What does he do? He runs to that fountain and he drinks as much water as possible, because he don't know where the next fountain is going to be, because he's got to keep walking in that desert. So I use that analogy to tell you that immigrants come to this country and their first priority is economic achievement. And secondly, their priority is academic achievement. So they send their kids to school, they work three jobs, they buy a business, and that's their focus, right? Now, once they've established and become more ingrained in the American system, then they become a little wiser, hopefully, that although we've achieved academically and we've achieved economically, politically we're stagnated. In the Indian community, Indians are of minority groups, the highest paid, the most economically advanced. They have the highest degrees of postgraduate degrees in law, science, medicine, but they are the least likely to run for office and the least likely to win political office and the least represented, right?
Right.
So many minorities share this dilemma. So I think it's a matter of educating them. I think it's a matter of having them shift their priorities and adding that third peg to the hole here that, you know, hey, political involvement is so, so very important. Sita, you have heard this, and anyone that's politically active has heard this. You're either on the menu or you're sitting at the table dining. And if you're not involved politically, you know, somebody else...
You don't get a seat at that table. Well, you know, I was... Exactly. Even like when President Trump had that Muslim ban, a lot of people didn't understand, you know, what was going on, and then they want to complain and they want other groups to fight for them. But I'm like, no, you have to fight for yourself. You have to show people that you did come to the United States, you assimilated. You know, we don't get to choose our ethnicity and we don't get to choose our race. That's how the good Lord made us. But by being positive and getting involved, we can help so many people who are feeling the way they feel right now, disenfranchised. And, you know, so I think it is imperative that people look at you and what you have done to help people from the Caribbean and what you're doing here in the United States and say to themselves, I don't want to wait till I'm 60 and 70 and 80 to get involved. When you're young and strong is the time you should be giving back. And that's what I see a lot too, is people put it on the back burner and they say, I'll get involved later on. Well, there is no later on. We need to get involved now to see the changes that we want to see affect in our communities and our children.
And at the very least, vote. Like, everyone, just vote, because you have no say if you don't just spend that half an hour, even less if you get a vote by mail. And just make sure that you have your earned right. You're a citizen. You have the right to vote. So I hope everybody who comes to this country and becomes a citizen uses that right.
So tell us a little bit, we're going to transition. So tell us a little bit about, give us an overview of what the property appraiser's office does. Because, you know, this morning somebody was walking with me at the gym and they said, I had no idea that was an elected position. And I said, it is. And I gave the person your website.
Yeah. So it's a very gray area with the majority of the public. Most people confuse me for the tax collector, but I'm a constitutional officer, and there are 67 property appraisers in the state of Florida. To become property appraiser in Orange County, I needed 338,000 votes. So I tell you that to tell you that it is a countywide race that I have to run to become a property appraiser. To become a state legislature in your neck of the woods, your state representatives probably have to get 20,000 votes. To become a state senator in your neck of the woods, they probably have to get 40,000 votes. So I wanted to shed that light on, you know, how vast this office is. It's a countywide office. Property appraisers are responsible for fairly and equitably assessing the assets of the county. And they're, you know, here I'm referring to commercial property, residential property, and businesses. We also assess the tangible assets of those businesses. We determine that value utilizing acceptable appraisal methodology, and that value is derived at and given to the Department of Revenue, who essentially will look and create this tax. The tax roll is created, and they'll sign off on it and send it back to the local municipalities. In Orange County, as an example, I have 16 municipalities, 16 different cities, and those mayors and county leaders will essentially fix their budget based on the value. They'll apply a millage rate, they'll look at their expenditures and derive a tax bill, tax burden, and you as the taxpayers will receive from my office a proposed notice of property taxes in early August. That's your time to say, hey, my value is too high, too low, or indifferent. I have an issue with this particular thing, and we will give you the jurisdiction that you're responsible to call to get those issues remedied. I, as a property appraiser, if you're contesting your value or you disagree or you don't understand, well, that's where we come in and we say, hey, come in and talk to us. We want to explain to you how we came, how we derived this value. So in a nutshell, that's what property appraisers do in the valuation area. We're also the gatekeepers of exemptions, and I heard you mention homestead exemption, but there are many other exemptions. I spoke on a disability panel last Friday here in Orange County. There are many disabled exemptions. There is a widow and widower's exemption, fallen hero exemption. So again, a lot of exemptions that's available to folks that property appraisers are responsible for.
I didn't even know that. I'm glad you're shedding light on that. I had no idea there was a disability exemption.
Oh, yeah, there are lots of disability exemption that the state offers.
Where should people go if they want to learn what exemptions are available to them? Because maybe a lot of people listening don't even know that they have exemptions that they can claim.
Sure. So the exemptions, I recommend for them to go to our website. We do a nice job of detailing it. It's OCPAFL.org, OCPAFL.org. That's our website. And navigate through the website, and it'll give you a list of the exemptions. In addition to that, property appraisers are the largest collector of data in local government. So we're responsible for a tremendous amount of data, GIS technology. What property appraisers will typically do, what I do in my county, is create maps for a sheriff, create maps for first responders. We have interlocal agreement with our supervisor of election, a clerk of court, all the other constitutional offices, and the county. We are the backbone for them when it comes to technology. So, again, it's a multifaceted position, and it's a very, very important position in local government.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of people who get their tax bills, they don't even understand it, and they don't even take the time to read it. But if there's one little issue like that they don't like, then they'll get involved. But I'm always, you know, I'm always concerned why people don't sit down with their tax bill, go over it line by, because there's a lot of line item things there.
Yeah, I just pay it. Like, I'm like, all right, whatever, yeah. I don't know. So it would be nice to understand it a little bit better.
We were just saying, you know, like, I know the way I was raised and you were raised, a home. Everybody wants a home, you know, like we did in the islands. It's brick by brick, mud by mud, whatever they do, you have a home. And we were saying how wonderful it is when someone actually owns a home and the pride that goes with it. Why do you think that is such an issue here, that more people don't promote home ownership the way our parents did?
You know, that's a good question. Yeah, I think it's a generational thing. You know, the millennials don't want to buy a home. I've got two millennials that I'm still responsible for. I'm referring to my kids.
Yeah.
My daughter, for instance, she's a real estate attorney. Grew up in real estate. Real estate flowed through her veins. And she was apprehensive in buying a home. And I had to kind of twist her arm. Finally, she bought a home. So I think it's a generational thing. Millennials don't want the responsibility. They're very comfortable. They have other priorities.
Well, they have us. They have you.
Well, and they saw home values tank
so
for a lot of people.
That's one of the issues with our millennials, but it is what it is. Our next thing is an opportunity. You know, I spoke at this conference that we talked about a few days ago, and affordable housing came up. And, you know, I said before people, think about housing, they should be thinking about food. And we've got a lot of organizations here in Central Florida don't pay their people a living wage. So, I mean, people are not going to be worrying about housing if they can't afford to put food on their table. So these corporations and businesses ought to step up and start paying people a living wage.
Well, and they won't even qualify anyway.
I was able to do that as property appraiser my second or third year in office, paying our folks $15 an hour. Everybody at the Orange County Property Appraiser's Office make a minimum of $15
an
hour.
Good for you.
You know, I was able to do it. It wasn't easy. But I think every CEO that's operating a business should definitely look at it and find ways to make it happen. This is our responsibility to our people, you know. So, again, going back to the housing issue, paying folks a living wage will fix a lot of that, you know.
Yes, it will. And, you know, all the 13 municipalities in Orange County saw a market value growth. Now, you worked in collaboration with so many people on that, but what is your driving force for what you have done to have such a profit, such a benefit in Orange County, Florida?
So I'm an appraiser by profession. I'm the first state-certified qualified appraiser in the history of the Orange County Property Appraiser's Office. And I came to this office with appraisal eyes, if you will, with a real estate background that understand the importance of accuracy and valuation. So when I looked at the tax roll, I looked at it with a completely different perspective. My predecessors were politicians, and they really didn't know. It was just unconscious incompetence. They didn't know that they didn't know. So I looked at it with that perspective, and I made some drastic changes, brought on some talented appraisers that were able to value and defend. It's not important just to value the assets. You've got to defend these assets. And we were able to ensure that everyone were paying their fair share. In Orange County, we had theme parks that were assessed less than the Amway Arena. We had theme parks that were assessed less than the Dr. Phillips Performing Arts Center. And again, if those big municipalities agencies, organizations weren't paying their fair share, well, then somebody had to pay that tax burden. So it rests on the backs of the taxpayers. The single mother that's working two jobs to make ends meet would have had to pick up the tab for those companies. So I make sure that the tax roll was fair and equitable, and that was responsible for a lot of the growth that we're seeing today.
Yeah, you know, my daughter bought a house right off of Goldenrod. Is that your area too? Yeah, and she She loves it. And she, of course, she bought her first home when she was 24. And she's an attorney as well. I think I told you that your daughter is an attorney. Yeah, mine is. Yeah. And she was saying to me, she said, "Mommy, you know, it's because you and Dad guided us and taught us how to save and taught us how to, you know, think about when you pay rent." I mean, some people can't help it. They have to rent. But she always says, "I remember Daddy saying, when you rent, it's like putting money in somebody else's pocket." And I think today a lot of parents don't give children the tools after they leave high school to think about credit card debt, and to save that 20% is so important. And that's where you and I get that from our grandparents and parents. And I think that's what immigrants bring to the United States. We bring a lot of experience from the older people as well.
Yeah, well, I think it's done out of urgency. I think it's done out of having, you know, that urgency to save. Every penny counts. You know, and again, the immigrants bring a tremendous work ethic to America. Immigrants bring a tremendous sense of advancement. You know, I don't know what the statistic is, but in the Indo-Caribbean community, you know, people are here 2-3 years and they're, boom, buying a house. How does that happen? That's happened by exactly what you said. They save every penny.
Well, you take one chicken and you make it into 7 meals. I remember taking one chicken and cutting it up and putting it 3 pieces for Monday, 4 pieces for Tuesday, put it with a little red bean, maybe a little lentils, a little dal, whatever. But you made it work so that at the end of the week, you were spending $30 on groceries while people were buying a cup of Starbucks. You know, nothing against Starbucks, but $6, $7 for a cup of coffee. You add that up, that's a couple $100 a month, you know? But anyways, so I noticed you're doing a lot of events around the county. So tell us, where can people find you, Mr. Rick Singh, property appraiser in Orange County, Florida, to listen to your wonderful speeches, your life story, and all the wonderful things you're doing for the people here in Florida?
Well, we do a tremendous job in getting the message out. I think it's very important for us to, whenever possible, mostly the underserved community, get the word out about these exemptions. So we hold satellite offices all across the county, and we've done this in a very unique way, a really cost savings way, because when I took office, we were renting kiosks in Florida Mall and the Millennium Mall and all these malls, and the return on the investment wasn't really there. So again, putting on that entrepreneurial hat, I said, okay, how can we solve this problem and meet more people? So, I mean, there were churches that invited us, fire departments, libraries, public buildings that we go to now, and we were able to hold satellite offices all across the county. So that's one way. Those satellite offices are listed on our office. I typically speak at a lot of events. I think we've spoken to over 200 events a year on average since I've been in office. So again, those events are on our website. We hold a big event, the biggest event for government in Orange County is held by the property appraiser. We get in excess of 1,000 people, and that is the State of Orange County Real Estate. It's coming up August 22nd, and it's going to be at the Wyndham Hotel on I Drive. Again, information for that is on our website.
So give us the website, and Ellen will post it on our website as well.
Sure, ocpafl.org. And as soon as you click on the website, the State of Real Estate will pop up. So please register for that.
Well, your commitment to Orange County and to all of us here is just commendable. We want to thank you for calling in. You're such a good friend. We're proud of you. And again, Ellen, if you have anything else to add to him, we'll put that on our website.
Yeah, it's all on the website already. It's also on our Facebook page under CETA Media, Inc.
You know, Rick, one of the reasons why you're successful, I think, is because you're so reachable and likable. You are one of those people that even though you've been elected into office, you have not changed. You have remained a people person. And, you know, when people talk to you, they feel like you actually care and you're giving them that one-on-one. And we don't find that in a lot of people who are elected into office. And I hope and pray that you stay in this office as long as you want, and whatever your heart desires, you have my full support and the people that know you.
Yeah, I mean, I tell when I speak to young people, I tell them, look, in life there's only 3 reasons you do things. You do things because you're told to, you have to, and you do things because you love it. And I love what I'm doing. My job of serving the people is, you know, it's tremendous rewards for me. I get a sense of joy, a sense of accomplishment. and I truly enjoy it. So when you sincerely enjoy it, I think that resonates and that shows. Thank you for saying that.
Thank you for being on the show today. And Sita, we got to take a quick break and listen to our sponsors, and we'll be right back after this quick break.
Portions of Viewpoint with Sita and Friends is sponsored by the friends and family of Sita Begee, author of 18 Brothers and Sisters, and founder of Simply Sita Skincare, and these great sponsors. Portions of Sita and Friends is brought to you by Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture Store inside the Merritt Square Mall at the Sears Wing. Save big on furniture working with a flexible family-owned store with all the brands you love, from Ashley, Serta, Coaster, Enso, and more. Brand new, warranties as well, and delivery and haul away available at a fraction of the cost of most stores, and delivered in 7 to 10 days. Free, no credit checking and financing, and free interior design. The owner, Scott Palmer, has been in the mattress and furniture business for over 30 years, and Cloud 9 has been serving Central Florida for 7 years now. Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture Store, available at 321-459-2473. Again, call them 321-459-2473 or visit them on the web at cloud9furniture.com. Jotkoff Financial Group is a certified public accounting and a registered investment advisory firm with over 30 years of productive relationships with clients. Jotkoff Financial Group can assist you in meeting your accounting, tax, and business consulting and financial planning and insurance needs without expanding your internal workforce. With 3 locations here in Florida, here in Brevard County, Broward County, and Nassau County, contact Jotkoff Financial Group here in Brevard at 321-984-7345. Located at 1122 South Wickham Road in Melbourne, that's Jotkoff Financial Group. On the web, you'll find them at www.jotkoff, that's JOTKOFF.com. Call the professionals at Jotkoff Financial Group today.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. We just had a really robust first half hour with our friend Rick Singh, who is the Orange County property appraiser. And we crammed a lot of thing in a half an hour, from saving to owning a home to appraising a property, why he got into politics, what immigrants bring to this country. Yes. Laura got in a few questions, yes. Ellen. It was just awesome.
Great segment.
I like him a lot. I've known him a long time, and he is a very good man, and he's doing his best, you know, as an elected official.
Very articulate and very concerned about helping his constituents.
And I'm a little biased because he's Indian, like me too. So that's wonderful when one minority does something well, it shows the rest of us up too, you know. And so our second half of the show, we've got a friend who's called in before. Mona Sheikh is calling in. She is. A great lady who combines a South Asian sensibility with Americanized values. And we both cherish the First Amendment. We both have that right to have big mouths, which I am one. And we do know that freedom of speech comes with a responsibility, and we try to do that nicely. And sometimes we have to bite our tongue, but we do. So Mona's on the phone, and she's taking the time to call in from L.A. She's a comedian, and she's also the editor, right, of the Minority Reports with a Z?
I'm the producer of Minority Reports with a Z. Yes. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, you know, you're such a wonderful friend, and I love all your Facebook activities, and I know you're busy, and it's just, thank you. I'm delighted you could call in, but I see you doing a lot of other things in as well as comedy, and you're having shows, and I saw you had the Desi Girls Night Out, you had the Persian Girls Night Out.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit. First, tell our listeners, how did you get involved in comedy? Because usually the Indian mommies and daddies, they go the route of engineer, doctor, lawyer, or else.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I think I speak this on behalf of all Desi parents when I say I'm every Desi parent's worst nightmare. I'm a single woman in my 30s who's a college dropout, who's a stand-up comedian. I mean, I think I literally sum up the worst nightmare. If you if you talk to any busy parent, you're like, describe your nightmare, they would describe me.
Yeah.
It would describe. So, I mean, how did I get into it? Honestly, people ask me, like, how did you get into comedy was never part of the plan. So I'm a former finance person. I used to work on the trading floor, believe it or not, for Citibank in New York. But I always wanted to be an artist, and I wanted to be a stage actor, so I started pursuing stage acting. And then when the market crashed and everything, and I was like, oh, I think this is a sign from God. And I went to an amazing acting coach who told me that I was funny. And I was like, but I don't want to be funny. I said, I want to be a dramatic actress. And he goes, no, that's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. You should try it. And I was like, okay. And then I tried my hand at stand-up and kind of never looked back. So
Do you write your own routines?
I'm a full-time stand-up comic.
Where do you get your material? Is it something where you just pull from your own life? And do you write about that? Or do you, you know, pull from other you know, people who sort of help you get your material together?
You know, a lot of my comedy is political, observational, definitely cultural, so you don't have to go very far for that.
Right.
But, you know, just all the trauma from the childhood also serves as fantastic.
Oh, I think Indian girls have a lot of comedy in their life. Like, you know, like somebody, yeah. Somebody was saying to me, well, how can you forget a child in the backseat of a car, right? And so we were seeing where all these children are dying because parents are forgetful. But an Indian parent would be like, well, I'm going to tie something onto the car seat so that when I come out, I'll pull the car seat out. Or they'll say, I'll give you a code word. Or they'll tell you like a million times, don't forget the child. Don't forget the child. Don't forget. But the thing is, our culture is funny in a way, but it's also the way that we learn.
Yes. I mean, I feel like every culture has their own kind of comedic element because every culture is doing things where, you know, you're just like, well, it's dysfunctional. What I'm trying to say is every culture is dysfunctional because human beings are dysfunctional.
That's right.
And there's a lot of comedy in that. But I feel like when it comes to South Asian parents and even Middle Eastern parents, there's, you know, I do a lot of the comparison stuff like, you know, one of the things that I started talking about, and not to get on a dark note here, is that, you know, school gun shootings is a really big problem in America. You know, and shootings, period, but school gun shootings is a really big problem.
Well, look what happened last night in California.
Gilroy Garlic Festival. I mean, but the fact that, you know, there's regular shootings and then there's kids who bring guns to school and shoot up the school. And I was like, you know, you never see this kind of stuff in Pakistan or India. Kids don't shoot up the school there. You know why? Because we get our asses whooped when we grow up. That's why.
Yeah.
And kids in America don't get that. I'm sorry. Like, white kids
They didn't really, in Baltimore, remember? Remember that black mom went in the middle of the whole riot and pulled their kid out? That was like the best.
Well, you know, Mona, last night after that... Last night I was watching CNN in between watching my Lifetime shows, right? And I'm like, okay, so there's a shooting. And for the life, you know, I just said to myself, God, I hope it's not somebody with a minority last name, a Muslim last name, a Hindu last name. I was like, God, please don't. You know, isn't it sad that today in America when there's a shooting, a mass shooting, that we have to pray that it's not somebody with a funny sounding name?
But you know what? But racism has always been in America.
I mean,
since the time of Christopher Columbus, for God's sake. Think about it. Christopher Columbus landed, thought it was India, started calling Native Americans Indians,
and
they're not Indians, okay? And to this day, we call them Indian. What? That's madness.
It is.
That's not the right India. Talk about like crazy racism. It's like, wait, but that's not who they are. They're Native Americans. They're like, no, they're Indians. We're gonna stick with that because I think you're Indian, so therefore you are Indian. That's insanity. I mean, racism is very much a big part of American fabric. I mean, throughout history, we as an American society, as Americans, have always chosen to pick on certain groups of people, and everybody kind of gets their turn. So right now, it's Muslim and Mexicans. I try to pass myself off as Mexican at the airport, but that's not going to work either anymore.
Yeah.
Do you find, like, using humor to deal with these issues, to deal with, you know, different cultures in this, like, really charged political environment we have today. Do you find that helps build bridges with people when you can take these issues and sort of make them a little bit humorous?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, comedy always softens the blow a little bit, right? Comedy always kind of makes it a little bit more digestible to have a conversation, difficult conversation. But I think the political climate that we are living in right now, if this is some, our president is a stand-up comic, and that's terrifying because he's taking the job away from us. This is the first time an American is taking a job away from an immigrant. I don't like this.
Yeah.
I don't like this.
Well, he gives you a lot of material.
Well, you know, I remember once on Saturday Night Live, they said, boy, they don't even have to look for material anymore because he gives them so much. But why, like right now, I mean, when Barack Obama, when President Obama was there, we knew he was black. Everybody could see that. You know, but the thing is, we didn't feel, like I was saying to somebody at the gym, I said, I always knew I was Indian. I always knew I was Hindu. But I also felt Americanized, right? Because we assimilate really well. We work hard. We give back. We get engaged. We train our children well. But all of a sudden, I find myself, and I don't know if this is happening to you as well, but somebody in the public and somebody who ran for office and all that, I find myself actually looking at my skin and I'm like, yeah, I am dark. What the heck? You know, because it's like all of a sudden you are aware you're not blonde and blue-eyed and light-skinned. You're not. And that happens not just in the U.S., but all over the world, right? People are judged by skin color. But it's like now it's in your face. You can't help but say, I am a minority.
Well, people have the like, liberty to say it now.
Yeah. So do you find that's happening to you, too, that you just have to say, well, I am a minority. What can I do with it to make the world a better place, you know?
I mean, the thing about me is that nobody's confusing me for a white girl. So let's just get that out of the way. I think, you know, that's not happening. Nobody's ever been like, Becky, is that you? So, no, that's literally never happened to me. I just think that, you know, you talk about, I've always been very aware. I guess because I'm an immigrant, I wasn't born and raised here. I moved when I was 15 from Pakistan, and I think I've always been very aware. And New York, you know, it's interesting. I grew up in New York City, and I feel like I'm a lot more aware of my brownness when I go to New York versus when I'm in California. Because Cali is so liberal, and Cali is so accepting, and you just kind of are just like, oh, okay, another brown person. Oh, okay, whatever. I feel like I was just there for 10 days doing shows and stuff, and I just feel my brownness a lot more in New York than I do in Los Angeles. I don't know what.
Well,
that
that's almost. Well, it's like watching Hindi films, right? Now, all of it's always been that the girl, the light skinned girls, always got the part
where that comes from.
You know, from the British, of course. But you know, even when you watch the shows, you'll see the girls now. Everybody, their hair is either blonde or red or brown. It's like all over the world, everybody wants to be somebody they're not, and it happens in our culture as well. I know when I go to Trinidad, you'll see dark-skinned Indian girls with blonde hair, and you're like, dude, what are you doing? You look silly. Stop.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. I mean, I feel like that has a lot to do also with identity. I think identity plays a huge role in it, where people somehow you fetishize another culture, where you fetishize the white culture. You're like, oh, yeah, being white is beautiful. If I'm blonde, I'll be prettier. If I have blue eyes, I'll be prettier. If I just bleach my skin, I'll be prettier. And, you know, I mean, we all know where that comes from. That just comes from years of colonialism. That comes from years of being told that what your skin color is and what you are is less than. But the craziest thing is that, you know, when I moved from Pakistan, one of the biggest things that I saw was tanning and the tanning culture in America. And I was like, okay, we're trying to look like you in Pakistan, and you're trying to look like us in America?
Yes.
This is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. And that, honestly, that is probably the most human thing that you can experience, because you look at that and you're like, yes, at the end of the day, you can try to claim yourself to be superior than the other person, but at the end of the day, we're all just human, fighting through our insecurities, trying to not feel like garbage, trying to please our parents, trying to, you know, get that next job, or trying to just be happy. That's what we're trying to do at the end of the day. I think people are just trying to meet the exact same needs, but then, you know, on the surface, you look at it and you're like, oh, this is, you know, people are just doing all these things, which is about, you know, getting blonde hair or whatever and bleaching their skin just to feel good about themselves because they think that that will make them feel good about themselves, you know?
Well, you know, comedy is it's art, and you do it extremely well, and you've done it where you're opening some really great acts. Now you have the Minority Reports. You're doing, you know, you have the way you're blending. Of course, you know, my husband's Persian and I'm Indian, so you kind of blended us together as well. But where are you getting where are you getting your drive to do so much? Because when I look at your Facebook and I see the things you're doing, you look like your life is a lot of fun. And I want to come to LA to one of your shows. And maybe Laura will come too. And Ellen.
You know, on Facebook, my life looks like a lot of fun, and I want to have her life too. So I don't know who this girl is. I'm just like, wow, this girl looks like she has a lot of fun. I don't know who this girl is, but she looks like she has a lot of fun. You know, I am in a place in my life where I'm looking at the world around me, and I'm looking at, you know, I started Minority Reports 5 years ago at the Comedy Store, and I made history by being the first brown person or Muslim person ever to have my own show there. And from when I took the show to them, nobody was even doing remotely what I was doing, right? That was like a first of kind of a concept. And I look at how things are evolving, and, you know, being a stand-up comic, being in this world, working, you know, in the stand-up comedy world, working with all these comedians, I'm just like, I want, the drive comes from a place of, the truth is, it's like when people, especially a woman of color like myself, and there's a lot of us, by the way, we don't get lineups. We don't get spots.
We have to fight very hard. I think we challenge ourselves.
Forget about fighting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Forget about fighting. Forget about fighting. It's not even an option. It's like of 20 or 25 that of us are out there, or 30 or 50 of us that are out there, maybe one will get a spot. Maybe. And I just don't come from the mentality of scarcity. I don't come from a place where it's like, oh, there's only room for one. I believe there's room for everybody.
Yeah.
And I wanted to create that platform, not just for myself, but for others too, where it's like, oh, we can have a lineup where, you know, I've showcased close to 500 diverse comedians in the 5 years I've been in business. Imagine that. These comedians that you'll never see on regular stage get to come and perform at fantastic venues, amazing, packed out, sold out shows that I put together. And I'm very proud of that. I want to be the hub. I want Minority Reports to be the hub.
And that in itself is a gift, because there's so many people, when they have a talent, a gift, or the ability to do what you're doing and bring people together, they don't reach out. And so I want to commend you for that, because I do know of people sometimes.
Thank you.
I remember once my daughter had done, you know, she didn't do as well as I expected in a certain test. And one of my Persian friends said,
really? A disappointed Desi parent?
Yeah. And so my Persian friend said, you know, Sita June, let me show you what should be done so that she can increase her scores. And that's what it takes, is friends helping friends, people helping people, people understanding that, you know, in this big bad world, all we have to do is change our behaviors towards each other, because we're all humans at the end of the day, trying to survive and, you know, put value in our lives and the lives of our families as well. And I think it's really wonderful that you do that, because a lot of the comedians that you do help, nobody is there giving them a hand up either, you know?
That is correct. That is correct. Nobody's doing this for us. Like, so for instance, you were talking about Persian Girls Night Out. So I wanted to do a red carpet event, Persian Girls Night Out at UCLA. And I feel very, very fortunate. This was our largest show, red carpet event-wise. I've had bigger shows than that, you know, turn-up-wise. But this was huge for us, because we had, like, big celebrities who came and walked our red carpet and supported. And it was such a validation for what I'm doing and the path that I'm on. You know, we had to.
And, you know, we like to dress up. You know, people from India, Pakistan, the Caribbean, Persians, just tell them an event and people will come.
I mean, the thing was that with the Persian community, you know, this was strictly for Persian community. We had a handful of other brown people show up. But, you know, Persians are, you married to a Persian, Persians are bougie.
Oh, yeah.
Frenches are the bougiest people I've ever met.
They are.
That's not a word I've ever heard
Girl,
before.
They are. Let me tell you. You know, my husband asked me. My husband asked me Saturday. He said, "What are you?" My husband asked me on Saturday, "What are you doing today?" I said, "Well, I'm gonna have coffee with you. Then I'm going to the gym. Then I have a luncheon and a fashion show. And then I'm going to sip and stroll in Cocoa Village." And he said, "So what time will I see you?" I said, 10 o'clock tonight." But you know what? He's a good guy. A lot of men would be like, "What the heck? Are you a wife or are you like just, you know, belong to the community?" But when you have a radio show, you're in the public, you have to go out and market yourself. And you know what? You have to have fun while doing it so that people believe in you and they respect what you're doing. So anyways, but yeah, I think that's a good term to describe the Persians.
So when you're like on stage, I always wonder this about comedians. Like, it's so terrifying because you're depending on the people in your audience to actually find the things you say funny. And like, what happens when you get up and you think something's hilarious and the audience just doesn't laugh, or even worse, they heckle you? Like, how do you personally respond to that? I'd like cry or something. Like, how do you handle it and be strong and keep going?
You do know that. Well, I don't know. I don't know if what kind of comedy you've seen me. I mean, that's my first act. I just get up there and cry first.
Oh, okay. I can do that.
Yeah, I just get up there, I just cry, get their sympathy, get them to feel sorry for me, and then I'm like, now I'm going to do my set. Let's do this. Here's a couple of skill sets as a stand-up comic after years of doing it. So you have your material that you go up with, you know. I compare comedy a lot more to more like boxing. You know, as a boxer, when you go up, when you step into the ring, you know, you already have figured your opponent out. So in my case, as a comic, you know, comedians stand in the back and watch their audience and listen to how their audience is responding to other people's jokes. So you're already prepared. You're listening to what they're reacting to, what they're not reacting to. Oh, is it a dance room? Is it a fun room? You know,
you have to know your audience. Yeah, you got to know them.
Exactly.
So that comes from, know your audience. Read the room, right? You have to read the room. You can't just go up there and be like, okay, I just have this joke and that's what I'm going to do. That's not how comedy works. You can go up there with the most phenomenal set, but if the audience is not feeling you and you have no rapport, or if the audience is just a bunch of, you know, being difficult, you know, you have to call it out. You have to call it out. You got to go do the crowd work. You got to talk to the audience, you know, build that rapport. And
yeah, I think it's a relationship, and you have that relationship with the audience.
That's exactly what it is.
So we have a minute left, Mona, and this is so, well, he says 10 seconds before, 30 seconds now, he says. Give us your website for the Minority Reports, and how can somebody find you if they want to attend one of your shows?
Yeah, absolutely. They can go to minorityreports.com, so www.minorityreports.com. And I just launched a brand new website for Mona Shaikh. So you can just go to Mona Shaikh, which is MonaShaikh.com. Or you can follow me on Twitter, Instagram at Mona's Comedy, or find me on Facebook at Mona Shaikh Comedian.
Well, we thank you for calling in, and I'll definitely have you call in again. I am going to see you when I come to LA. I have your number. I'll call you. Thank you so much,
please,
for all you do and making all of us look good. And it's just wonderful. Another great edition.
Thank you so much for having me, ladies.
Thank you. Another great edition of Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. Folks, tune in next Monday at 1 o'clock. We'll have some more great guests.
This is the Christian Voice of Brevard on WWBC 1510 AM.
And you're listening to WWBC, Cocoa, Merritt Island, Melbourne, Titusville, and the Beaches, as well as W234BI, Cocoa,